Welcome to Your Call's One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind. Climate change is increasingly impacting every aspect of our life and the environment in multiple ways, from higher temperatures to sea level rise to drought, flooding, and more. So how should we understand this rapidly warming world? And in what ways are climate-related shifts in other parts of the globe impacting our cities and our communities here at home? Well, in his new book, Rising Waters, Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World, our guest today, veteran journalist and four-time Pulitzer Prize finalist Tony Bartelme, takes a deep dive into the front lines of the climate crisis. He asks what it means to bear witness in a world that's changing fast and what it will take to change directions. From his hometown of Charleston, South Carolina, to the rapidly melting ice sheets of Greenland and disappearing coral reefs, Tony explores how the distant consequences of the climate crisis, which are invisible to many of us, pose very real threats to communities thousands of miles away. Tony Bartelme is a four-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, a senior projects reporter for The Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina, and is author of the most recent book, Rising Waters, Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World. Tony, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Ethan, it's great to be with you today.
Well, congratulations for this important, very timely book, very readable book. Now, you've been reporting for over 30 years, and your work on climate stories has really stood out, not just for its depth, but also how you unpack these complex issues of science, climate impacts for readers. Now, just given the state of the country right now, the Trump administration and Congress's organized assault on climate action, on climate science, I just wanted to open by asking you what really concerns you most right now as someone who's covered these issues for decades?
Yeah, that's such a key question with such high stakes. And I think my biggest concern is just this sense of fatalism that a lot of young people feel about the climate crisis, that, you know, that there's nothing that they can do about it. And I think that's the biggest impediment to taking action, because really, in the end, nothing's going to happen unless we all take some urgent actions, and look at it not so much as, you know, climate change anymore, but look at it as the climate crisis.
Yeah, that sort of climate doomerism can be really self-defeating. And I think it does seem like you're seeing a lot of that. And some of that has been sown deliberately to try to get people to despair and not feel like they can take action. Now, I know you're the senior projects reporter for The Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. And in the book, I read that The Post and Courier has created the Rising Waters Lab, which funds climate reporting. And that you mentioned that $5 for every Rising Waters book purchase will go to the lab. I mean, it's such a refreshing approach to see that a newspaper is dedicated not just to covering these impacts, but really figuring out a way to fund this ongoing journalism. So can you talk more about that particular project and how it came about?
Yeah, you know, climate journalism, climate reporting is, you know, takes time and a little bit of expertise. And, you know, not many, you know, local newspapers do that anymore. And so we've essentially created a nonprofit arm that, you know, collects donations and grants, and that funds two reporters who focus on infrastructure and climate issues. And, you know, that manifests itself in, you know, in a couple of hundred stories in our paper, in our community, in our state, that wouldn't be told without them. It's a huge impact.
Yeah, it's so important. We've covered just the state of local journalism on recent shows, and it's wonderful to see that this sort of vision for how we can keep this journalism going. And before I turn to the books, I do want to ask you a lot of questions about the book. I wanted to ask you, because you just, you know, made this comment about sort of despair that you're seeing. I'm curious, what are you hearing from your readers, from your colleagues about climate change, how people are thinking about it, if you can sort of generalize at this point?
Yeah, I think it's the absence of talk that bugs me the most. And that's, I don't know, I've been thinking a lot about this lately and you know, and how to kind of overcome this apathy. And I think, I don't know, I came across this study a few months ago that looked at a bunch of researchers looked at the experience of awe and wonder, and they we're actually able to conclude that if you train yourself to experience moments of awe and wonder three times a day, that that is a more effective than an antidepressant. And so in a lot of, the book, a lot of my climate coverage, I really try to keep that in mind. Keep that sense of wonder and that awe, because in the end, I think that's what gives you the energy to take action. It makes it worthwhile.
Is appealing to
So,
people's
yeah.
emotions, their imagination. Absolutely. And I think that's what's so effective about the book. Again, it's called Rising Waters: Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World. And it really does bring these anecdotes to life. You're reporting on the ground, and you cover such a wide range of topics in the book, starting with fossil fuel driven CO2 emissions that you can actually visualize. You get a camera that can actually visualize those and depict those emissions that are otherwise invisible. Can you talk about why you decided to write the book and what went into your thinking about how you arranged the stories that you were telling?
Yeah, in some ways, the genesis of the book didn't begin with a climate issue. It began with a horrible police shooting here in Charleston. There, in 2015, there a white police officer shot a black man in the back 7 times as he was running away. His name was Walter Scott, and that was a big story. It was captured on video. And whenever the newspaper kind of is involved in a big story, it's all hands on deck, and we all hit it hard. And we spent the next month looking at every single police shooting in South Carolina, and created this sort of definitive database that looked at police shootings and patterns. And it created some change. Finished that project, and then immediately after that, white supremacist guns down 9 churchgoers in Mother Emanuel AME Church. Again, horrible, horrible acts. I knew one of the victims. Happened right behind my son's school. All hands on deck. By the end of that, those 3 or 4 months, I was mentally toast and looking for some, getting back to beauty. I was looking for something, some beauty in my lives, and I came across this book called Plankton. It was a big coffee table book, and it had these beautiful photographs of these microscopic organisms in the ocean that produce half of the oxygen that we breathe. And I was first taken by the pictures, the beauty of the pictures of something I'd never really understood. And then that fact that they produce 50% of the oxygen that we breathe. And then I thought, how did I not know that? How did I not know that, our most, important oxygen producers are in the ocean? And then, of course, that led to a project looking at what is this, chemistry experiment that we're doing to the ocean and our most important oxygen producers. And then
It's
from that, we realized, there are a lot of stories that are hidden in plain sight when it comes to the climate crisis.
such a great example of that. The plankton that literally is microscopic, and that is so fundamental to our world and our ecosystem, our human survival, and yet the impacts of climate change are invisible to us, except for what we see now with the effects of extreme weather event. And I'm also curious if, you're being based in Charleston, South Carolina, if that has shaped how you're viewing the issue of climate change or how some of your readers are viewing it. We know that Charleston in particular faces a number of risks from climate change that you talk about in the book, from extreme heat to flooding to extreme precipitation, drought, another challenge. What are you experiencing just on the ground in Charleston?
I've been here in South Carolina for a long time, 30 years. Also, a shout out to my brother who lives in the Bay Area. I love the Bay Area. I've got connections there and family. It's a home for me. But South Carolina is in an area, or the Charleston is in an area known as the Low Country, because I think 800 square miles of this part of South Carolina is less than 4 feet above sea level. $24 billion worth of property is in, property that's just 4 feet above the water. My house on a bad day, and it was supposed to flood today, it'll get up to my knees, or and sometimes thighs. It gets that deep. The water comes and it goes, and we kind of live with it. So in a way, we're sort of adapting. But yeah, so it's a very personal experience for us. Where I've seen, the changes in the weather, dramatic changes in intensity and frequency of the storms. And the area itself is kind of becoming more tropical, more like Florida than it was. It's very personal, very real. I experience it, all the time, the
Yeah.
impact.
Well, given what you're describing, I think, pretty much anyone anywhere on Earth who's lived a decent amount of time has observed similar changes in where they live. And South Carolina, of course, is not known as a hotbed of climate action. A lot of the elected officials there are not supportive of climate action. How do people, generally in South Carolina view this issue if they're experiencing what you're experiencing with these changes? Where are they at sort of politically in terms of climate action, and what might it take to kind of break through the divide that we have in this country around this issue in places like South Carolina?
South Carolina's as red as a stop sign, right? And it's and South Charleston's a little more purple. But when it comes to the climate, I think there's an interesting coastal inland break. The folks on the coast, we've seen the hurricanes, we've seen the just we see the rising water, we see the flooding on a high tide and how it's different. So I think there's a kind of a personal experience aspect in the low country that sort of decreases the denial. Our stories get very good receptions for the most part. There are a few cranks, but it's the deniers are mostly inland who don't experience it. And they probably won't change their minds until they do feel some pain, that it may have happened with Helene in North Carolina with the terrible hurricane and flooding up there, and probably future wildfires like you all have out in California.
Yes. Well, we're speaking with Tony Bartelme, a four-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, senior projects reporter for the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. He's also the author of his most recent book, is called Rising Waters: Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World. And that's what we're talking about here for this hour on Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind. And if you have questions for Tony, if you have observed climate impacts, if you have thoughts about what we should be doing to try to make this issue more salient to people who otherwise are not as concerned or motivated to take action when it comes to climate change, we're opening up the phone lines and the number to call to join the conversation. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or go ahead and send us your email with any questions or comments to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Tony, your book opens with a really interesting illustration. You write, "Imagine you're walking down a path on a beautiful day when suddenly, right by your feet, you spot a poisonous snake. What do? You don't check your Instagram. You don't try to reason it away. Your brain, specifically your frontal cortex, lights up and sends a clear message: get the hell away from that snake. But here's the problem. Climate change is like an invisible snake. We can't see carbon dioxide. We can't always feel rising sea levels or melting glaciers, especially when they're happening on the other side of the world. So our brains don't respond with the same urgency. They stay on standby." So, Tony, as you approach this book, how do you overcome that dynamic? What was your thinking and how we approach this sort of basic cognitive challenge we have where there's this invisible force, but it's as threatening to us as an actual snake might be, a poisonous snake on the ground?
That's the key thing. That's what I want my stories to do. And that snake anecdote actually was based on a real life experience as we were tromping through a place called the Santee Delta, which is mentioned in the book, and we almost stepped on a copperhead. So it's that was not invisible, but that kind of brought it all home. One of our sort of key projects was when we got this camera that has, it was made by a defense contractor, and it is able to visualize carbon dioxide emissions and plumes, just kind of like almost like a thermal imaging camera. And I went around town. I got the camera. It was kind of cracked me up because the guy said, "Oh yeah, it's like the only one of its kind in the country, and it's like $90,000, and just don't break it." And he FedExes, this, very expensive rare camera to the newsroom. And as soon as I got the camera, I felt like a kid in a candy store. What can I shoot? And the first thing I shot was, our columnist, a guy named Brian Hicks, who's, a lot of hot air. And then I was started going around, what is burnt? What burns? And I took a picture of my tailpipe, car tailpipe, and then I started going to coal plants. And I don't know. So after a while, I suddenly realized that we're just surrounded by, we're surrounded by all these invisible fires because we've done a pretty good job of cloaking our internal combustion engines. And so we don't see the fires that are moving around in traffic. That was really dawned on me that we've, that provides a path toward solutions if we just need to put out these fires in any way we can.
It does seem so powerful, and the one, the images you have in your book really do illustrate how powerful it is to see that exhaust from the tailpipes, which is otherwise invisible. Is there any hope for just this technology becoming more widespread, this camera technology, just to, so people can see more visuals on the news of the pollution, that's the carbon dioxide pollution and the other greenhouse gases that are causing this crisis?
Yeah, no, I honestly don't know why other news organizations, they haven't called up and asked for those cameras. It's pretty cool.
What was the reaction you got? Did you share those pictures with readers? I know they're in the book, but what was the public's reaction to it?
Oh, readers kind of, surprisingly ate up this stuff. You would assume, here we are in South Carolina, that we just get a bunch of hate mail. But it was actually the opposite. Some of our climate stories were among our most read in those years, and eventually, they were put into the book. Our climate coverage is very, very well accepted now. There is a way to do them though, and I, given where I am, I often will sort of ease readers into a story instead of just, hit them over the head, the sky's falling, life's about to end, that kind of doom and gloom. That's going to turn people off because I don't know about you, I'm into this stuff big time, and even I can't read some of these stories.
Yeah, it's too disheartening, and it does feel like it kind of saps you of your energy and motivation to take on action, which I think is why the fossil fuel industry, this has been part of their playbook to kind of help spread and invest in this sort of doomer message so that people do feel like it's kind of helpless. But I think you are in such an important part of the country, and I think have such a interesting perspective on how to communicate around this. So, have you found that talking about solutions has been an effective way to kind of bridge that divide with people who don't otherwise necessarily accept climate science or the need for climate action? Has it been leading with solutions, or are there other angles that you found have been able to really resonate and break through?
Honestly, the solutions thing, it's one of those things that sounds good, but I don't think it kind of works. I think people who are opposed are just going to just turn off no matter what. So my one effective strategy with people who have somewhat open minds is to say, yeah, look, the climate has always changed. And then they say, oh yeah, right, climate change, yeah. And then you say, well, the difference now is that it's about the pace of change. It's just happening faster. And sometimes that'll light up they'll have a little light bulb pop up, but most of the time it's a tough battle.
Yeah. Is there at least consensus on climate, what we call adaptation or resilience? You know, that people, maybe they don't accept what's causing it, but they understand it's happening and that we need to do more to protect our communities from the impacts. And, as I talked about, what you're facing in South Carolina from flooding and drought and sea level rise along the coast. Is there consensus around at least trying to deal with those things?
I think so. There's I think a rising sense of, hey, we got to do something. It doesn't, and that bridges partisan lines. There's a, an effort, big effort in Charleston to build a wall around the historic district, and it'll cost billions of dollars, but you have to do it to save the city, because it already floods, and it already, at a high tide, you can see the water actually percolate up through the pavement in some parts of the city, like somebody stepped on a sponge somewhere, and it popped up somewhere else. So you can see the water kind of coming in. So we're, the ocean's a big bathtub, and the bathtub is full, and it's spilling into our, the heart of our historic district.
Well, and I know it was reported back in July that South Carolina's major electric utilities are moving ahead with plans to build massive new fossil fuel power plants and pipelines, locking the local communities there into decades of increased air pollution, fossil fuel emissions, greenhouse gas emissions, et cetera. What what is the state of the sort of debate around some of the solutions we need, you know, in South Carolina? Because we see that solar panels and batteries are often the cheapest form of new electricity to put in place. I mean, are there people who, like I say, maybe not in favor of climate action, but still seeing the value of renewable energy to reduce co-pollutants or just for the economics of it?
Yeah, here's where I, you know, because of my connections in California, I know what you all are doing, and you're national leaders, and in South Carolina, we're national laggards when it comes to that. And, you know, our utilities don't get it, you know, or maybe they get it and they just don't want to get it, but they're looking at building a giant gas plant when like you said, you know, the solar and batteries are, you know, the cheapest form of electricity now. We could do it quickly, you know. So yeah, journalistic standpoint, I've reported on this. To me, that there are a lot of options and answers and solutions out there. They just have to be done. And the frustrating thing is I just don't see them happening here. I see them happening elsewhere around the world, and in California and out west in some places. We're a little stuck in time here sometimes.
Well, it's wonderful you're able to cover these issues and at least, you know, explain to readers what's happening. What about rooftop solar? I mean, that's something that you even see a lot of conservative groups kind of clamoring for because it means they can reduce their utility bills. You know, they even refer to it as freedom solar. Is there a push for more rooftop solar, at least in South Carolina?
Yeah, there's a fair amount of rooftop solar going in, but it's not enough. And I don't know. There's a lot of flat roof distribution centers going up, and a lot of space for solar panels. And I don't know. We have a big manufacturing plant by Boeing. They make planes here, and you know they took off their solar panels. Mm-hmm. You know, there ought to be more. It's a very sunny place, and but Dominion is our big, you know, utility down our way, and they're not leaders when it comes to this stuff.
Well, Tony, just to go back to the book again called Rising Waters, Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World. Something that really struck me in the book was how many top scientists in the country have really been working on this issue, researching it for decades when it comes to climate change. And you and your colleagues traveled, you know, to Greenland in particular to see the ice sheets melting there. You talk to a NASA scientist who moonlights as an Elvis impersonator and also leads the agency's Oceans Melting Greenland project. First of all, what's the latest on those agencies given the cutbacks that we've seen? And also curious if you can just, you know, paint a picture a little bit about what you did see in your reporting trip up there.
Yeah, no. So we why would a local newspaper, send a journalist to Greenland? And I don't know. That actually began with a kind of a joke to the editor. It was really hot. I don't do too well in the summer here because it's so hot. I'm originally from Minnesota, editor comes over to me and says, "Hey, how are you doing?" I said, "Oh, I don't know. It's too hot. If I really wanted to cover the climate crisis, right, I'd go to Greenland." And he laughed. And then I started thinking, it's exactly what we need to do. Because what's happening there has a direct impact on whether my street floods. So we ended up getting a grant from the Pulitzer Center. And two of us went to Greenland, and really with a vague idea of, hey, let's just watch the ice melt and then try to connect that with readers. And we also spent a little bit of time trying to connect with this NASA scientist who works for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory down in the LA area, who moonlights as an Elvis impersonator, and sings about the climate crisis. And he's known as the climate Elvis. Super guy. And we were able to connect with him as they flew around these icy areas and essentially dropped thermometers in the ocean to measure how much, how the ocean was changing and whether the ocean, warming ocean, was affecting the melting ice. And so that was one of their final years of that project. And I think that project ended. I'm not exactly sure what the cutbacks are doing, but it can't be good.
Well, we definitely have a lot more to ask you about with Climate Elvis. Heartbreak Hotel comes to mind, and what you found up in Greenland. So we have more. We're talking to Tony Bartelme, four-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, senior projects reporter for the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. We're talking to him about his book, Rising Waters, Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World. I'm Ethan Elkind. We have a lot more for you here on Your Calls One Planet series. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. Welcome back. For those of you joining us just now, I'm Ethan Elkind, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We're podcasting the show, and you can find out more information on our webpage. Visit kalw.org. Click on News, and you'll see our program listed there. If you click on that link, you can also listen to our past shows and subscribe to the Your Call podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. If you have a show idea for us, please drop us a line. We're at yourcall@kalw.org if you want to email us. And of course, you can join the conversation today by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We'd love to hear from you. Are you experiencing the impacts of climate change? Have you noticed changes where you live over the decades, over the years? We'd love to hear your stories. And given the dire state of the country when it comes to climate action, as well as other issues, of course, what do you think should be done at the state level to not only address climate change, but come up with an effective plan of action to move away from fossil fuels? The number to call to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Our guest today is Tony Bartelme, four-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. Over this past 30 years, his investigative work has exposed government corruption and explored diverse issues ranging from changes in ocean plankton to the global shortage of doctors. He's received the highest honors in journalism, including recent awards from the Gerald Loeb Foundation, Scripps Howard Foundation, and Knight Science Journalism Program at MIT, and many more. Tony is the author of, or co-author of, several books, but his most recent is Rising Waters, Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World. And Tony, as we were heading into our mid-show break, you were talking about your adventures in Greenland. Can you talk about the connection? You said you went up to Greenland without really knowing how it might link to what's happening where you're based in Charleston, South Carolina. But can you talk about what is the connection between Greenland and a place like Charleston, South Carolina?
Yeah, so the you know, there are many impacts from Greenland, and you know, of course, you know the amount of melting that's happening there is insane. When you actually see it, it sort of stops your heart. And you know, it's kind of like, you know, if you imagine putting, you know, ice cubes in a cup, you know, if you put too many ice cubes in the cup, that, you know, causes that cup to spill. And Greenland's ice is just gigantic. It has like, you know, it has it's a country that's the size of Mexico, and 80% of it is covered with ice that's 10,000 feet thick. You know, it's a huge amount of ice that's falling from going from land into the water. So that's raising sea levels. But one of the really things that I'd never heard about, and that I don't think is very well known, is that there's so much ice that's so thick, and, you know, ice is heavy, that it actually exerts a gravitational force that pulls the water kind of like a miniature moon toward Greenland and then away from coastlines far away. Kind of like, you know, if you imagine pulling a rug, you know, it's we're in South Carolina, we're at the other end of that rug that pulls the ocean away from our coastline, lowering our sea level. And so if, you know, that ice, you know, that melts as it is, that essentially disperses or reduces that gravitational pull, the ocean sloshes back a little bit. And that's just another little, you know, addition to our sea rise equation. And in a place called, you know, called the Low Country, every inch matters. So we, you know, we kind of went up with that sort of basic science story, which is, you know, kind of wonky, but, you know, I thought pretty cool. And then we go to Greenland really to, you know, to put our feet on the ice and really bring that connectivity to our readers.
Yeah, what was that like? There was, we have some video. I believe we can post it on our website for people who want to see some of the video that you were able to be a part of up there. What was that like being up there? What really stood out to you?
I don't know, man. When I first got off the plane and then was driving down a hill and I saw these icebergs the size of islands, you know, off in the distance, it was one of the most emotional things I'd seen. I'd seen a lot of places and I'm fortunate to see a lot of places, and I was blown away by the sheer scale of the icebergs. And yeah, it was just imagine the kind of the Grand Canyon, and instead of the beautiful browns and reds and oranges of the canyon, imagine a similar canyon but with blues and beautiful whites shimmering in the sky. And but then imagine that Grand Canyon is, by a factor of 100 or 200. It's so massive. That's what's happening there.
Yeah, the scale of it is really something. And all that ice, all those ice sheets melting also have an impact potentially on the current, the Gulf Stream that goes from essentially around the Gulf of Mexico up to Europe. And you talk about that in the book at some length. And you talk about the importance of that current and some of the history of the science around it and what the perils are now.
Yeah, the Gulf Stream is part of this amazing conveyor belt of ocean currents that wraps around the world, from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The ocean is, just think of it, a bunch of a conveyor belts of warm and cold water. And, like a good radiator, these currents, keep our climate more moderate. If these currents would slow down, you would expect the climate to be a little more extreme, which is, I don't know, maybe raise your hand if you're seeing extreme weather.
Yeah.
The Gulf Stream is part of something called the AMOC, which is flows all the way up toward Greenland and then falls in an invisible waterfall, essentially, and then forms a deep water current that flows south back into the Gulf of Mexico and then kind of keeps circulating. And the concern is among some scientists is that as this current system heads toward Greenland, this slug of fresh water that is coming off of Greenland is essentially kind of creating a wrench in this conveyor belt. And if that conveyor belt slows down enough, that has just a ripple effect across Europe. It'll make Europe colder. And it'll be, and it'll actually, for a bunch of reasons. So just to pull back a little bit, the Gulf Stream flows with so much force off our coast. It's just about 60 miles off our coast. It flows with so much force that it actually pulls the ocean away from our coast, kind of like a centrifugal force. And that lowers our sea level by 3 feet. And that, people might be amazed by that, there's proof. In about 14, 15 years ago, this Gulf Stream slowed down suddenly, and scientists were completely stunned by it. And it slowed down by about 15%. And because of that, the seas in New York, New England-ish areas rose 5 inches for months before the current regained its flow. So it does have a huge impact on our sea rise equation.
It's really remarkable to think of the ocean essentially being pulled away by this force, by this Gulf Stream. And it's fascinating to kind of delve into that. And what are the scientists saying now about the state of that Gulf Stream and what the perils might be?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I love the wonder of that, kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, just the sheer force, this river in the ocean that we don't really, we don't really see, has such an impressive impact. Scientists are more and more, maybe 10, 15 years ago, some were saying, oh, no, we got to, this could happen. Now more and more evidence is piling up that, yes, it's happening, and there's some very dire, predictions. I kind of like to stay away from the future predictions a little bit, because that sort of, again, takes us away from the moment and creates that sense of fatalism and doom that I think is hard to manage amid all the garbage.
Yeah.
So But again, kind of getting back to what's happening now, we are seeing a slower ocean current system that's very troubling.
Well,
Now,
and one of the things you also point out is that if that heat is not sort of exchanged by being pulled out of the Gulf Coast and heads up north, it's going to create sort of supercharged storms. And we have reports from CNN about tropical storm Imelda right now strengthening, expected to become a hurricane by Tuesday, moving off the southeast coast. It's already creating a dangerous surf and rip currents from Florida through the Carolinas where you're at. And at the same time, Hurricane Humberto, which briefly exploded into a rare Category 5 storm on Saturday, is now a large Category 4 hurricane. And so the two are kind of moving somewhat, it seems, in tandem here. How are things going now on in the Carolinas where you are looking at these storms? What are people experiencing? And do any of the weather forecasters, meteorologists, they link these intense storms to what's happening with the warming Gulf and warming oceans?
No, I'm glad we're able to talk today because there was a lot of concern a couple of days ago that we were going to get hammered by it. And fortunately, the European model was the correct one, and it's veering away. Unusual. These two hurricanes are really interesting. This Umberto is so strong and so powerful that it's kind of yanking Imelda away from us. So thank you, Umberto. But yeah, our forecasters kind of they focus on the weather less than the climate, unfortunately.
Yes. Well, we're speaking with Tony Bartelme, four-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, author of the book Rising Waters, Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and I'm Ethan Elkind. The phone lines are open if you want to share your stories about how climate change has impacted your life, how you think journalists should be communicating on climate change. How do we reach people who aren't familiar with or don't accept the climate science? We'd love to hear from you. The number to call to join the conversation, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, and speaking of hurricanes, one of the things you talk about in the book is the connection between what's happening in the Sahara Desert and how that's connected to some of the storms that we see in the United States on the Eastern Seaboard. Can you describe what you learned and what you covered in the book on the sands of the Sahara?
We after we did our project on the Greenland connection, we just thought, what other sort of connectivity can we help our readers understand? And I'd always been fascinated by the fact that dust from the Sahara flows across the ocean, and then kind of lands on our windshields now and then, and in a reddish film. I'd come across that, I think, in a John McPhee book, decades ago. And so I began to do a little research on that, and learned how dust from the Sahara actually floats into the trade winds, and right in the area where our worst hurricanes are born, and then acts like a switch. So if there's a lot of dust, it essentially kills off the storms before they really form. It kind of smothers them like a blanket on a fire. So a lot of dust is kind of a good thing for us, and so. But then I wanted to know, what's happening to this mechanism, and so we decided, how do you tell that story in a novel way, and I thought, okay, well let's go look at the dust, kind of like we did in Greenland. Let's go look at the ice, and then I also thought, what are researchers in West Africa doing, because science has long had this North American and European tilt. And so I worked really hard to find scientists in West Africa who were doing, turns out, groundbreaking research into how the dust travels and its mechanism. So for me, it was a little bit of a climate story, a little bit of a social justice story. I'll take a look at this, this incredibly important mechanism that could affect almost all of our readers, if the dust isn't there.
Well, you have such a powerful passage in the book. You write, "The ocean off West Africa is the hurricane nursery where our worst hurricanes were born. And this origin often reminded me of another important steering current. Slavery and its legacy had long shaped South Carolina's past and present. And watching the trade winds carry those tempests toward us felt like karmic revenge." That's quite a powerful passage, you know, given the history in South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, South Carolina, you know, Charleston was, you know, the where all, some, you know, some estimates a third or more of all enslaved Africans were brought through Charleston and then transported to other areas of the country. So it's, you know, how can you not think about the trade winds and that route without thinking about slavery and its legacy, which, you know, permeates every bit of our city's, you know, politics and culture. So you have to honor that, I think.
Absolutely.
So that was part of, that was kind of part of my, yeah, that's when I mentioned kind of social justice, you know, that was part of my thinking.
And of course, not just affecting the city, but the state and the nation as a whole. So I think it's really an amazing, wonderful parallel of the climate impacts and this tragic history that we're still grappling with today. I want to ask you about one more story in your book before I ask you kind of a series of more general questions here. And that was your reporting about the growing danger of algae blooms, which can spawn toxins as deadly as cyanide, and that we've been seeing them appear now in Northern California, these toxic algae blooms, and you report on how they've been smothering manatees in Florida, here in California, wiping out sea otters. Can you talk about the link between climate change and these harmful algal blooms and why they're occurring?
Yeah, no, California's got a serious problem that's affected animals and you know, and people's economies or economics and a lot of effects. So, yeah, it's a really relevant issue. And kind of long story short, you know, the warmer it gets, just, you know, we're all experiencing a giant chemistry experiment. And, you know, as we heat up the world, as we heat up water bodies, you're going to have, you know, growth of algae. And that's going to, you know, algae is this really interesting, you know, it's interesting organisms that essentially are, you know, in a constant state of chemical warfare, and they create toxins as a natural defense and will often create novel toxins that we don't know about. And yeah, so that's a danger that we're not really looking at either, because the CDC has been hammered and a lot of other scientists are being yanked out of that area of expertise.
Well, there's also a pretty surprising national security angle that you talk about. You say you got a call from a general who told you that algae blooms could actually be a national security problem because they can be used to make chemical weapons. It's not an issue that I've really been seeing getting a lot of attention. Can you tell us more about what you found?
Yeah. He was very concerned, and there are a lot of scientists who are very concerned who know that this stuff is very toxic, can be used as a bioweapon. It would be very easy to use it as a bioweapon and be hard to trace. So if we can't identify, again, it's going back to those invisible snakes, you know, if we can't identify those invisible snakes, we're going to have trouble getting out of the way. We're going to get snake bite. So, you know, that's the importance of our scientists. They're our detectives in a lot of ways. They're not just, you know, people, you know, goofing off with test tubes. They're identifying important evidence that help us, heroes in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And they definitely need more respect and support in this day and age. We're speaking with Tony Bartelme, four-time finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, senior projects reporter for the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. He's talking about his new book, Rising Waters, Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World. I'm Ethan Elkind, and you're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. Phone lines are open if you want to tell your stories about how climate change is affecting your life. If you have thoughts about how we communicate better when it comes to talking to the public about climate change, what journalists could do, the number to call is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. We do have an email in from Dave in Richmond, who writes, "We borrowed money to put solar panels on our roof, We traded in our ICE internal combustion engine car for a used electric vehicle. Our savings are amazing. Our debt is evaporating. Curiously, many of our friends refuse to follow our lead. And he signs off as baffled. I'm curious to hear from you, Tony. There is such a strong economic argument in favor of climate action. Does that tend to resonate in places like, you know, the broader South Carolina community, where, again, maybe people don't care so much about the pollution impact, but the bottom line, their economic bottom line, could be, you know, an appealing way to reach them? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, Dave's right. You know, it's, you know, I've got a bunch of neighbors across the street in a historic district who have solar panels. They pay almost nothing for their electricity. It's there's this amazing intangible feeling of not having to pay the man, right? You know, so yeah, Dave is right. His neighbors are wrong, and it's, you know, it's a matter of taking action. And I think inertia is the problem. You know, that apathy and I don't know, this addiction to comfort, addiction to entertainment, you know, that is preventing what actions that essentially would be beneficial to not only individually, but to our community as well. I was actually thinking about, you know, kind of why I wrote, you know, this book and why I was writing, you know, these stories and kind of my thoughts sort of drifted to my mother, who's a teacher. She was 86 years old when she retired from the public schools in the Bronx. And she years ago brought a bunch of teachers to South Carolina for a retreat. And I gave a little spiel about plankton. And I didn't think I was being a downer or a buzzkill. But at the end, a teacher raised her hand and said, you know, Tony, do you have any hope? And, you know, I thought, oh, I don't know. And I gave her, I didn't want to disappoint a teacher because they're like, you know, like living manifestations of hope. Mm-hmm. But I gave her a bad answer. But it made me think a little more deeply about hope and how, you know, hope is really, you know, what we need to get out of the bed. You know, it gives us the energy to take actions now in this moment to make better decisions for our future. But if we just have hope and take no action, hope is just nothing more than a pleasant fantasy. Yeah. So we need hope and action. And, you know, that's why I dedicated the book to my mom, you know, a teacher.
Yes. Well, as you say in the book, apathy and cynicism are climate denial's twin cousins. Mm. And you also argue that the solutions aren't invisible snakes. So I'm sure people often ask you, what can we do? What do you tell people when they want to hear about that action, not just the hope, but the action? What are the solutions that you are trying to communicate on?
Yeah, I think, you know, there are a lot of things that people can do in the moment, and small and large. You know, the next car should be a plug-in hybrid at the very least. You know, we need to electrify our transportation. California is a leader in that. South Carolina is a laggard. And then there are little things like get rid of your gas-powered leaf blower. Those things are horrible. Ultimately, it comes to working your utilities. You know, a lot of people don't maybe write their congressmen, but they might not write their regulators. So, yeah. You know, make your voice heard. Your regulators are essentially are the people who are representing you when it comes to a regulated monopoly. You have a right to have your voice heard.
Well, wonderful advice. We have a caller, Sylvia in Berkeley, dialing in. Sylvia, we don't have a lot of time, but if you have a quick question for Tony, we'd love to hear it.
Well, actually, there's a little organization in Berkeley, California called Seacology, Seacology. It's run by a former head of the Global Environmental Awards, the Goldman Environmental Awards, and they've actually saved 1.5 million acres of land, ecologies, and animals on the island nations around the world. And as everyone knows, the island nations are the most vulnerable to sea water rise. So something can be done. They have a very small budget, and they don't need much money. They have a small staff, but they've actually saved 1.5 million acres of land.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Sylvia, for just raising attention to the good work of Seacology. So hopefully listeners can check that out. And Tony, it reminds me of a question I did want to kind of leave with you and the program with, essentially, is, you know, as we think about stories like that, there's so many hopeful stories, nonprofits like Seacology. What do you recommend that journalists think about when they're trying to tackle these issues? Should they be focusing more on those stories? Do you have any sort of advice for those trying to cover this issue?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you know, the climate crisis is the most important issue of our day. You know, hands down, it affects our insurance rates. It affects, you know, so many of our lives in so many ways. We're seeing it with every catastrophe. So journalistically, I think from a journalistic management standpoint, we need to recognize that and own it and then hit it hard in any way, in as creative way as we can. So that's sort of my hope. You know, I think we're starting to, you know, we're seeing better work than we were 10 years ago.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think part of that better work is the work that you're doing. And I just want to thank you for coming on Your Calls One Planet series, and also for highlighting the invisible dangers and the things we need to do in the book Rising Waters, Reports from Across a Rapidly Warming World. Author Tony Bartelom, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet. Thank you. And thank you for what you all do, too.
Well, we appreciate you coming on. And I also want to let listeners know you can join us on California Clean Air Day on Wednesday this week, October 1st at 7 p.m. at 2220 Montgomery Street in San Francisco. We're going to be having experts show how cleaner buildings can improve our climate and your family's health. You can learn all about practical solutions there, how to switch out your natural gas appliances to all electric solutions. Again, 7 p.m. on Wednesday, October 1st at our 220 Montgomery Street in San Francisco location. To register for this free event, go to kalw.org/events. That is our show. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit our webpage on kalw.org. You can also find us on social media and email any show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Malihei Razazan produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, and it's Your Call.